Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
What if we don't treat all of these human biases as bugs? What if they're actually features? What if we are designed to be biased in this way? And I started to think to myself, okay, now you've got my attention. What are you talking about? And it got back to something I said earlier. We are the most social species on the planet. We are the only species that interacts intensely in huge numbers with individuals that we're not related to. The chimpanzees don't do that. The ants and the bees don't do that because they're related to everybody else that they work with. So we humans are deeply, deeply weird. And then I start to feel some eureka happening because this science, this emerging science, which I'm going to call cultural evolution, said, we humans were not badly designed. We're not biased and flawed and all that. We are exquisitely well designed. And in particular, we're exquisitely well designed to be members of the most social species on the planet. So the biases and the bugs that we see and that we know about, these are features about what it means to be an individual within this incredibly social species.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Andrew, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Srini, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So you have a new book out called The Geek Way, The Radical Mindset That Drives Extraordinary Results, all of which we will get into. And as I told you, I think when I emailed you, what I loved most about this book is that it was a social science book disguised as a business book.
Don't tell anybody. I want to sell lots of business books.
Well, I think that was the thing that struck me the most about it. I was like, whoa, this is like an in-depth study of human behavior. You approached it almost like a cultural anthropologist. So on that note, I want to start with what is one of my favorite questions, and I think a fitting one given the nature of this book. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on what you've ended up doing with your life and career?
Is none of the above a social group?
Yeah, absolutely.
I grew up in a pretty small town in Indiana, and in particular, my family lived in a farmhouse on the outskirts of town. So I was geographically a little bit cut off, but then mainly cut off by my, you know, awkward personality and nerdy habits and interests and things like that. So the short answer to your question is none. I wouldn't call myself incredibly well socially integrated when I was in high school. I was in the band. I was on the math club. You're probably getting an accurate picture of what's going on. I was not in attendance at prom. I had a couple friends who were into the same nerdy things that I do, but you know, none of the above is probably the answer there.
Yeah.
Well, and like you told me earlier that you had a bunch of friends who went to MIT. I went to MIT, and one of the great things about that place is that it's where a bunch of, you know, weird, socially awkward, kind of marginal people, they all get together and they all realize that there are a lot more other people like them. And you start to form really deep bonds and friendships and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. What instrument did you play? I was in the band too.
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me. I played the French horn and I played it with great mediocrity.
Well, I played the tuba, but I played it with exceptional excellence. I almost hit ban three times. So no, nice. But the French horn is a damn difficult instrument. Of all the brass instruments, I remember people always said this is one of the hardest.
Yeah, and I proved that over and over again.
Well, you know, the thing I wonder about is when you kind of juxtapose this sort of, you know, none of the above personality with the environment that you grew up in, like what impact that ends up having on sort of your worldview and the way you see things. And because like based on just sort of, you know, my media perception of Indiana, it seems very Texas-like, you know, high school sports being a big deal. Much like yourself, I didn't go to my prom, even though I grew up in California.
Indiana is just the heart of the Midwest, right? So I do think that kind that Midwestern niceness and decency, that is not just something that you see on Fargo. That's real. And I think that part shaped part of whoever I am today. But I honestly think it's just having these fairly geeky interests myself, more of a bookworm than a computer geek when I was a kid, but out there on the computer geeky side. And so the great good fortune that I have these days is that I get to write books about computer stuff. And if you had ever told me that I could make a living doing that when I was in my in my awkward teenage years, I probably would have laughed in your face.
Yeah. Did your parents encourage any particular career paths, or were you kind of sort of self-directed in terms of going this way?
I got crazy, crazy lucky with my parents, who are both decent Midwestern people, who realized that, well, I don't think they were super interventionist anyway, but they didn't try. And even though my dad was super into horses and I wasn't, and my mom was really into opera and I wasn't, they didn't try to force their interests anywhere on me. And when they realized that I was this flavor of kid, that they're like, fine, here's all the books that you want. I remember my mom saying really early to me, I was 10 or 11 years old, and she said to me, I will never censor you. Whatever book you want, whatever material you want, I'm going to go get it for you. Now, of course, when you're that awkward and you're 10 or 11 years old, the last thing you're going to do is ask your mom for anything risque. So I think it was a brilliant strategy on her part, but she did mean it.
Yeah. Well, so you're at an academic institution, you're an academic, you know, and an author, and there's no conversation I get out of, you know, with an academic without talking to them about the education system at large. But I think the other aspect of this that interests me is that you're a Montessori kid, right?
Yep.
I'm only really observant of this right now because I have a 1.5-year-old nephew who seems to have this insane aptitude. The kid is playing chords on the guitar, literally.
Really?
Yeah. I'll show you a video after we're done. It's cool. Like scary. But the funny thing is, you know, my sister has been talking about like, where do we, you know, go to put him in school? And I'm like, there is no way this kid is going to survive in a normal school. He's going to get bored out of his mind. But there's something that you talk a bit about Montessori in general, but I think the line that struck me most is the part you transition into a regular school where you see the deepest mystery was why my autonomy and freedom had been replaced with so much pointless hierarchy and structure. It didn't make any sense. I eventually learned to get along and go along at my new school, but I never learned to like it or see the point.
Yep.
And as an educator, if you're tasked, especially as an educator at one of the most elite institutions in the world, let's say that you are basically brought into the next presidential administration as the head of education policy, and your job is to redesign the whole thing from the ground up, what would you change?
I would encourage more experimentation, and I would study the hell out of that experimentation. So, Srini, like you just said, my strong prior is Montessori, because I was a Montessori kid, and I think it was an astonishing gift my parents gave me. Earliest in my education, to have those years be oriented around exploration and poking at the world and going where your interests take you, as opposed to that, hey, here's a grid of desks and a new subject is going to come at you every hour. I feel incredibly grateful. But if I'm going to be in charge of anything as important as national education policy, I'm going to try very hard not to let my personal beliefs or my priors dictate. I'm going to say, great, you know, let's go study Montessori schools versus more traditional ones. Let's make sure we get this right before we go roll anything out that's as important as educating young people in a country.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that there's an interesting sort of paradox here when you think about the types of people end up at a place like an MIT, right? And I've seen this trend of like Montessori kids sort of being Silicon Valley CEOs.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, as a Berkeley undergrad, I think the thing that struck me most was here are some of the brightest like people that you could possibly find thrown together in this university. And over the course of 4 years, it starts to become a breeding ground for conformity.
Ha.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, you get these, like, here's, you know, here are the majors, here are the jobs that those majors lead to. And I've seen this pattern, even like, if you walk through the bookstore, through a Barnes and Noble where they have the, you know, education section for kids, and you go from like kindergarten all the way up to like sixth grade, it's like, whoa, the creativity just gets sucked out more and more with each grade.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. And it gets to something very fundamental, I think, that I talked about in the book, which is that we humans are the most social creatures on the planet. And literally, you saw this in the book, we cannot survive without other people. If you put any of us, the smartest people, out in the middle of any kind of moderate wilderness without extensive training, they're going to starve because they can't make a fire to cook food and keep warm at night. My point is that we are intensely dependent on being a member in good standing of a group. Our evolutionary history is kind of dominated by that. And so to think that we're not going to conform or we're not going to be influenced by the people around us and what they're doing, that's wrong. It's just not how it works. What I think places like MIT get right is that that environment, that social environment that I walked into when I was 17 years old, celebrated weirdness and nonconformity in some ways. And I would rather have that be the kind of social norm of the group than everybody better believe the same things and dress the same way and act the same way and try very, very hard not to stick out. I'm glad I've been exposed to some kind of nonconformist environments in my life.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is news that we have this industrial era education system in like the age of AI effectively. Why is it that it's so damn hard to change this whole thing? Like, I feel like, you know, because you think about it, like I was lucky enough to get into Berkeley. You went to MIT. Yeah. And I don't know what it was like when you were applying. But I remember applying to college and I was like, okay, I got into Berkeley. That's cool. But if you watch they show these clips of kids who get into like an MIT or a Berkeley nowadays. And if you watch the college admissions scandal documentary, yeah. And like you look at the reactions where it looks like a matter of life and death, the way that these kids like interpret whether they get in or not.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you know, what do we like? Why is it so like if we start to look at it at a foundational level? I mean, talking about it from the social species level, like, what is it that causes this to persist, even though we know that it's not actually designed for the future that's coming?
Well, there are a couple things going on, right? One is that you point out what you saw in the college scandal documentary, which is this intense pressure that high achieving kids, I don't know, you'll call them upper middle class or whatever you want, whatever label you want, the intense pressure they and their families feel to get into a good school, even though they're probably not going to starve in the streets, even if they don't. And I think that as our society changes, families and communities go looking for signals about status, about the, you know, here's a family that's high status. Here's a kid that's high status. Getting into a fancy school is one of those signals these days. And the reason it's a really, really powerful, durable signal is that the supply demand balance to get into fancy schools is way, way out of line. So in some sense, it's a meaningful signal. Getting into Princeton means that you survived a very competitive process. We can debate whether or not it's a healthy process or the best one, but it ain't easy to get into a school like that. So it's what, you know, what economists would call a costly signal. There's some information going on there, which is why we're relying on that. But you also asked another question, which is why are we still educating primary school, secondary school kids in this factory method? And the short answer is, I don't know. The little bit longer answer is it actually worked to generate the workforce that we needed for a lot of the industrial era. We needed obedient people with reading, writing, and arithmetic skills. There were a ton of jobs that needed to get done by that kind of person. So it's not a huge mystery to me that we built an educational system that turned those people out. Like you, I believe that the mismatch between that system and the workforce needs of today, let alone tomorrow, that mismatch is big and getting better very quickly. In addition to which, it does kind of drive the spirit out of a kid. And I'm not being too conspiracy theoretical. I think that was part of the point. I think the job was to turn out obedient people to participate in the workforce and the economy of that time. Okay. Yeah. Look, probably time to do something different. I still think we need to be educating kids to, you know, have the right values, but the right skills and the right orientation toward work, that's probably different than it was 50 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I love that you brought up curiosity because like I've been doing these like fun experiments with AI with my 1 year old nephew where I've just been keeping a list of all the words that he knows. And so for Christmas, we took all the words that he knew, we put them into his own custom children's book. And, cool. You know, every object was one he recognized. And my brother-in-law was like, this is crazy. Like he finds these books so engaging because they're designed around his personal curiosity. And I like, this is something I realized when I got to college, I felt like I was from day one under the pressure to make some sort of decision about what I was going to do with my life. And it's kind of funny because like, you, of course, nothing turned out like that. Like people would ask me in business school, what are you going to do when you get out? I was like, I don't know, as long as it has nothing to do with the internet. And, you know, clearly the universe has a sense of humor, but Well, you know, when you think about that first sort of stage, and I'd love to hear about from your own experience too, like, why is it that we don't have that room for exploration? Because one of my, you know, friends was like, you know, you get mismatched with a talent. When you mismatch talent and environment, you get shitty performance. And he said, that's effectively what happened to you. You is what he told me. He's like, you basically are a creative person who was never in a creative job. So everybody thought you were like lazy and unmotivated.
Yeah. Again, the short answer is I don't know. And I don't want to go too far into portraying myself as some kind of educational specialist or theorist. I do think that we have mismatched the environment with how people learn in general, and in particular for kids who are farther out there, for non-conforming kids, for kids with extreme abilities that they don't get to go push on all throughout their lives. I think school is a bummer for a lot of people, and acknowledging that and working on that is pretty important homework to do, I think.
Yeah.
I was lucky in that I was a kid who was capable of sitting in that desk, in that grid, and absorbing subject after subject, hour after hour, without getting too fidgety or acting out or needing Ritalin or anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, talk to me about sort of, you know, like what has led you to writing this book? Like, what are the inflection points throughout your career that have caused you to arrive at this perspective?
For my whole career as a business academic, I've had one foot in each economy, and that's a really dumb way to say anything. So let me unpack that a little bit. I have always studied the companies in the economy, the American economy, that are producing technology. So that takes you out to Northern California fairly often. I've also been studying the companies as they try to consume technology, try to bring it in and make use of it. And that's kind of every industry. The entire rest of the economy has been trying to consume technology. So for my career, I've been walking around, when I say Silicon Valley, I'm using it as shorthand for a lot of things, but I've been walking around the valley looking at technology producing companies and just kind of absorbing them, and then doing the same for, you know, I don't know, like a cement distributor in Minnesota who wants to profit from technology somehow. You know, again, I'm making all of this up, right? But there's this idea that I was in two different places, and over time, those two places seemed more and more dissimilar to me. They just felt different. They had a different vibe. They were operating by different principles. And one of them seemed to be doing better. Like, you know, there's been an astonishing amount of value created in that small piece of real estate in Northern California, especially over the course of the 21st century. By far the biggest companies in the world are based there. There's been extraordinary value creation there. And I started to say, wait a minute, these two things might not be unrelated. The different vibe, the different culture that's going on that I was kind of trying to absorb out west, that might have something to do with the extraordinary performance of these companies. And in particular, we all know that strategy matters and culture matters, but the strategy didn't seem to me to be the differentiator. Nobody that I talked to, no executive group that I talked to, is unaware of network effects anymore, or doesn't want to build a platform business, or has not heard of Moore's Law. That's just not the case. The you know, the entire economy is full of companies that understand that and want to do it. And, you know, I've tried to, with Eric Brynjolfsson, I've tried to write books to help them with that. The strategy awareness gap is not a gap. It's just, it's not a big deal. But there's something about the ability of a company to execute that strategy, to execute on some kind of technology forward playbook, that gap seemed to be huge and getting bigger over time. So I'm scratching my head about that. And at the same time, one of my geeky habits is I like to read books about other sciences that I'm not part of. And in particular, the science of why we human beings are so weird, why we have these biases, why we do what we do. That's always kind of fascinated me. So, you know, I've obviously bought Danny Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, and read that. But there's a recent development in that line of work that to me got deeper, because it said, wait a minute, what if we don't treat all of these human biases as bugs? What if they're actually features? What if we are designed to be biased in this way? And I started to think to myself, okay, now you've got my attention. What are you talking about? And it got back to something I said earlier. We are the most social species on the planet. We are the only species that interacts intensely in huge numbers with individuals that we're not related to. The chimpanzees don't do that. The ants and the bees don't do that because they're related to everybody else that they work with. So we humans are deeply, deeply weird. And then I've start to feel some eureka happening because this science, this emerging science, which I'm going to call cultural evolution, said we humans we're not badly designed. We're not biased and flawed and all that. We are exquisitely well designed. And in particular, we're exquisitely well designed to be members of the most social species on the planet. So the biases and the bugs that we see and that we know about, these are features about what it means to be an individual within this incredibly social species. And then to me, it's just like, aha, okay, this gives me a very, very first principles way to think about a lot of things. And in particular, if what we humans do is evolve our cultures faster than any other living thing, other living things have cultures. Chimpanzees have cultures. Chimpanzees are not launching spaceships anytime soon. They're just not. We're the only species that goes from looking at the moon to landing things on it. Then that gives me traction. Like, okay, our superpower as a species is cultural evolution. And it's a very short hop to go from that to thinking, wait a minute, what these companies that I'm so obsessed with, what they're doing is they're mastering cultural evolution. They're evolving their cultures faster than the rest of the economy, faster than the competition. They've figured out a playbook for very rapid cultural evolution and innovation and agility and execution. These are all just, to me, facets of this fundamental phenomenon of cultural evolution. I'm like, okay, great. I've got a bunch of examples and I've got what I think are first principles or a science that explains those examples. Now it's time to write a book. And I'll tell you, this was the hardest book. It's the hardest book I ever wrote. It was also the hardest book I ever sold because I kept having to try to explain to people that I didn't just want to explain the things that Silicon Valley does differently. I wanted to explain why those things are such good ideas, why they work better. And it took me quite a while to put that pitch together and try to sell the book.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think you answered pretty much every question I wanted to ask about that first section, which is when you said first principle, I was like, okay, that's why you laid the foundation with human behavior. I was like, because I was thinking, I was like, why would you lay this huge foundation explaining human behavior before you get into the four geek norms? But I think the you know, a couple things that really stood out to me in this part of the book, and you know, this really comes down to like groups where you talk about norms and you say that we adjust our behavior in all kinds of ways in response to all kinds of cues in order to maintain or improve our position in the group. And when the environment or when the group level environment shifts, we shift right along with it. Sometimes the resulting behavior changes are so big that it seems as if they could have only come about by swapping out the people involved. And then you talk about this idea of, you know, rank, and we look at what we can get away with. Which takes us to, you know, this rule of thumb where you say observability increases adherence to norms.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that and what that means.
So the basis for a lot of that, and thanks for reading that passage, because I really do believe that one of the mistakes that I think my community of people who study businesses and the people within them, one of the mistakes that I think my community has made is that we have over-focused on the individual. We have under-focused on the group. Now, of course, everybody in my community knows that groups are important and culture is important, but they think that the if you want to change things, the level of analysis, the way to focus, the place to focus is on individuals and teaching them to be less biased or more ethical or more moral or lecturing them to be better or educating them or training them. And I'm not saying that's worthless, but I think that pales in comparison to getting the group level environment right. And the example that I give to try to make that point as vivid as possible is this wacky social science experiment that was done in 1970 on the campus of the Princeton Theological Seminary, not Princeton University, but the Theological Seminary in Princeton, New Jersey, where these fiendishly clever people, and I'm honestly kind of frightened of very good social science researchers because I think they're evil geniuses. They figure out these crazy ways to manipulate us so that they can learn. But what these researchers did was they recruited a bunch of seminarians. And these are people who go to school for a long time to absorb the teachings of Jesus and try to propagate them, right? That's what they're there for. And the main, like the most fundamental teaching of Jesus is like, you know, do nice things for other people. And in particular, there's the lesson of the Good Samaritan, which is a parable that Jesus tells, where a Samaritan who was not the biblical Jew's favorite person sees a person who needs help and does the right thing. And the parable is incredibly straightforward, and Christ ends it by saying, go and do likewise. So, of course, these evil genius social scientists said, hey, let's go to a seminary where people are studying the teachings of Christ and see if they'll be good Samaritans or not. And in particular, they wanted to see if a couple things mattered. They wanted to see if personality mattered, so they gave a personality test. And they wanted to see if mindset matters. And mindset is a thing we hear all about these days. And again, I'm not saying it's worthless or irrelevant, but these researchers manipulated the mindsets of some of these seminarians by having half of them give a talk about, I don't know, careers or something. And the other half, they said, you're going to go record a talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. So get that at the top of your mind. So they could be assured that all of the people who thought they were going to go give that talk had the parable of the Good Samaritan at the top of their mind. This crystal clear lesson from Christ, help other people go and do likewise, help other people in need, right? Okay, so here's the evil genius part. They had the seminarians walk down an alley where nobody else appeared to be there, but there was a person in the alley who was slumped over, coughing, pretty clearly needed help. So they put an opportunity to be a good Samaritan in the path of all of these seminarians, including people who were thinking about the parable of the Good Samaritan. And some of them helped, some of them didn't, and some of them walked right over the person who was sitting there clearly in need of help. And the question was, what accounts for this difference? And the answer from all of this research was the personality type didn't make any difference. The mindset didn't make any difference. The only thing that made a large, measurable, reliable difference was whether or not the person felt they were in a hurry. Because these evil geniuses manipulated the amount of hurry out there. And for about a third of them, they said, oh, you're late. You better go right over. Now, if you're in a Presbyterian theological seminary, showing up late to an appointment with a professor is a norm violation. It's a thing you really don't want to do. And the people who thought they were late, in general, walked right over the person who needed help. So that's why I see enough examples like that, and I really start to believe that what we need to work on, if we want to make things different or better, what we want to work on is the group level environment, the norms, and to be even more precise, the observability. If that person were walking through a crowded courtyard and saw the person who needed help, the seminarian probably would have stopped and helped, I think. But because they knew they weren't being observed, they could let something else dominate. So to me, that really starts to get me thinking about, okay, if we want to make things different, we need to shift some stuff. We need to focus on the group and its norms instead of the individual. And we better do things like increase observability so that people can't tell themselves any story retrospectively about why they did what they did.
Wow. Dude, like hearing you say all that kind of makes me realize, like, you know, when my friend was asked, like, did you get straight A's in high school? I'm like, I'm Indian. Of course I got straight A's in high school. But the thing is, it's observability of norms. Like, that's what we observed from our peers. Like, all our peers were straight A students, and our parents didn't give a shit if we got straight A's. They were like, that was just what they expected. The only question was, like, why did you not get an A? You're like, if you got an A minus or a B. But it makes now, like, looking at it from this perspective, I'm like, oh, wow, we were adhering to cultural norms.
Yeah, and you absorb those almost unconsciously, I bet. It wasn't like you guys all sat around and said, okay, well, we better not get anything below an A minus.
Oh, no, I mean, we never talked about grades. Like, I never explicitly had my parents say, it's important to get good grades. It was just kind of like it was implicit to the point where what started out as like us trying to like impress them, eventually I realized what they did was implicitly they were teaching us the value of intrinsic motivation.
Yeah, and they were responding to the norms and the signals in their community as well. The other thing that a report card does, it's highly observable, and it makes your plausible deniability go way down. You know, Mom, I really got an A. I don't know why they wrote C on the report card, but trust me, it's really an A. Like, no, it's not. You can't wiggle your way out of that one. And one thing, and it sounds like I'm being super cynical about human beings, and I don't think I am. I think I'm trying to be accurate about our behaviors. Most living creatures on the planet want more benefits at less cost, at lower cost, cost of energy, costs of whatever. That's just good for your biology, right? That's good for your evolutionary success. So when I say that we will take shortcuts if they're available, I'm saying we do the same kind of thing as like a hummingbird will do or you know, an elephant seal. I don't care. We want to improve our cost-benefit trade-off. And so cutting corners in social situations or telling little white lies or telling retrospective stories, this is part of the human toolkit for improving the cost-benefit trade-off. Great. We should all realize that and not, you know, castigate people for doing it. But if you're designing a group-level environment, make it harder to cut those corners. It's a brilliant ground rule.
Olé. Well, let's get into the very first of the geek norms, which is science. And you start out the section on science by talking about overconfidence, where you talk about this idea of a press secretary. But one of the things that you say is that confident people have an easier time attracting allies, psyching out opponents, and attracting mates. And you talk about it from this perspective of what you call homo ultra socialis. So first, can you explain that term homo ultra socialis to people? And then I think it'll help kind of frame this a bit. More.
Yeah, I made it up, right? And I'm just trying to communicate that our species needs a label, and I don't like the label that we currently have. Homo sapiens is accurate, but it doesn't really get at what distinguishes us. What distinguishes us is our crazy sociality. And the label that some scientists use for us is for our sociality is ultra social. So I just Latinized that. And, okay, fine. We're homo ultra socialis. One thing that is really highly valued in an ultra-social species that does very complicated things is confidence. I mean, do you feel drawn to unconfident people? Will you sign up to be led somewhere by somebody who's like, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe. No, right? Confidence is a very, very important thing for a member of an ultra-social species to have. And therefore, and this is an insight that goes to Robert Trivers, who I think is the most important biologist since Darwin, the most important evolutionary thinker since Darwin. Trivers says, look, evolution has designed us to be more confident than is warranted in many situations because confidence is so valuable for us as a species. It's very, very elegant logic. I love it. And Trivers backs it up with a ton of evidence, which helps me understand again why overconfidence is such a common bias. You can elicit it very, very easily. It's very hard to train away from people. And it feels like this gigantic bug that you make worse decisions. Yeah, but you're more highly socially valued. It's not a bug. It's a feature. And so I start the chapter on science by talking about that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah, well, so it's funny because I kind of makes me think, how do you balance this sort of overconfidence with rationality? And I'm thinking back to an interview that Tim Ferriss did with Chris Sacca. And this always stayed with me from that interview where he was asking him, and he tells him the story about meeting Kevin Systrom, where Kevin Systrom is like one guy working in a co-working space after Bourbon has kind of gone through their pivot. And the thing that he says, like this just verbatim, I remember in detail, he's like, the thing that stood out to me was he didn't talk in conditional statements. Keep in mind, this was like before Instagram was Instagram. Yeah. He was like just saying, when we get to 50 million users, we'll do this. And, you know, the phrase that Chris Sacca used was the inevitability of success was like a common thing to all founders. So, of course, like you said, nobody's going to follow somebody who's not confident, but you also need to back that up with something, which is interesting because like, in the case of that early moment in the co-working space, it's like, is he really backing this up with anything other than, you know, the fact that he's not speaking conditional statements?
Yeah. And in that case, probably not. But he was acting in a very confident manner, and it stuck with Sacca for years afterward. That's the importance of confidence. The reason I lead off the chapter on the great geek norm of science by talking about this is because to me, it helps me understand what science truly is. And it's not an attempt to get rid of our overconfidence. It's an attempt to channel it. And in particular, to channel it so that we win at the game of science, where we're always going to argue science is an argument about the nature of reality. It's a debate. It's a constant debate with a ground rule. And the ground rule is we're going to settle the debate not based on charisma or seniority or who's got the bigger budget or who's wearing a Nobel Prize medal around their neck. None of that. The rule for science is we're going to settle the disagreement with evidence. And in particular, we're going to try to get to the point where if you and I are disagreeing on the nature of reality or what's going on, and you believe A and I believe B, you know, here's what we're going to agree on. We're going to agree on the experiment, the evidence we're going to go gather to distinguish between A and B, and then we're going to go run the experiment. And that characterizes some of the huge, you know, breakthroughs or steps forward in science. But the brilliance there is that it doesn't say don't be overconfident. That's a useless thing to say. It's a bumper sticker. It's not going to make any difference. What it does say is take all that overconfidence and channel it into doing the hard, boring grunt work of producing enough evidence to convince that other guy that it's A, not B. It's astonishingly clever. And until I started thinking about human beings as these chronically overconfident, ultra social, status obsessed creatures, I didn't have a great way to understand science. And now I understand. I think Trivers calls it the supreme discriminator. Science is the supreme discriminator of false ideas. The reason we get smarter over time is that we have channeled our overconfidence into, I'm going to do this unbelievably, in most cases, just kind of tedious work because I'm so confident I'm going to mop the floor with your worldview. I just adore that.
Well, you know, I think the thing that really struck me from this chapter was that, you know, what you and I and everybody else needs is to have our ideas stress tested. And that's what other people are really good at. Just like we're good at stress testing their ideas. Yep. And I mean, you've gone through the book writing process, so you know how like excruciating feedback is. You know, I described this, the process. It's like, oh, working with your editor or publisher is like an emotional root canal. You basically are going to get torn to shreds. And so one of the things I realized is like feedback is really difficult for people like that. I remember fear of public reaction was like one of the number one reasons people gave me when I surveyed my audience for like why they weren't doing this creative thing that they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And yet I was like, you know what? Like harsh feedback sometimes is invaluable. And often like I have a note literally that says, you know, like what you want to hear, you know, sounds good. What you need to hear is good. Ah,
I love that distinction. And I do think to the point that you made that evolution is so clever and we're such a groupy species that evolution has designed us to be lousy evaluators of our own ideas and good evaluators of other people's ideas. And the research on this is pretty wild. I talk about some of it in the book, but I'm convinced I'm really good at evaluating your ideas. I suck at evaluating them. I'm way too fond of them. And so I need you. I need you to give me feedback. And I don't love it because I want to be told I'm flawlessly brilliant and I don't have anything to add here, but that's not how we actually get smarter over time. And you said you have at least one parent who's an academic. I can tell you the academic seminar room is not your favorite place to be a lot of the time because you're getting this work and these ideas that you love so much picked to shreds by very smart people. Okay, yeah. That's how our species gets smarter. That's how it works.
Totally. Well, let's get into the second one, which is ownership. And you open the section on ownership by quoting the Simple Sabotage Field Manual ideas, which is insist on doing everything through channel, never permit, SARS to be taken in order to expedite decisions, be worried about the propriety of any decision, raise the question of whether such action as is contemplated lies within the action of the group or whether it might conflict with the policy of some higher echelon, multiply the procedures and clearances involved in issuing instructions, paychecks, and so on. See that three people have to prove everything where one would do. And I'm just thinking, I was like, yeah, this is why I don't have a real job. It's because of bullshit like this.
And I thought this story was so good that it had to be an urban legend, but it's not. The quote that you just gave is from a field manual for partisans behind enemy lines during World War II in Nazi-occupied territories. The OSS, the predecessor to the CIA and the start of the American intelligence community, printed up these leaflets called the Simple Sabotage Field Manual and kind of dropped them out of airplanes in Norway and France and countries like that to help partisans mess up Nazi organizations. And a lot of that book is based on, stopping up toilets and blowing up railroad sidings and stuff like, and short-circuiting electric circuit boxes and whatnot. But there's a chapter that's all about softer methods of sabotage. And you read it, and honestly, that excerpt that you have is perfect. It sounds like the procedures of a late 20th century, industrial era corporation. Just this elaborate thicket of ways to hold up getting things done. If you look at how companies actually go about getting their work done, it looks like somebody sabotaged them. I tell this example, which is apparently a true example, of a poor woman named Jennifer Nieva trying to get approval inside Hewlett Packard, which used to be kind of thought of as a decently managed company. In 2005, she was working there and she needed to get approval to spend $250,000. Okay, that's a decent amount of money. Maybe somebody needs to sign off on that. 20 people needed to sign off on that, including people she had never heard of in her life. She tells the story. She traced them down to an office in Guadalajara, Mexico, and called them every day until the last signature was obtained. And she said she spent so much time with one person down there that when this person updated their LinkedIn profile, they asked Jennifer for a recommendation. This is what companies back themselves into. And it's mystifying at first, right? Why would you sabotage yourself this way? Why would you promiscuously distribute the power to hold things up in this way? And the very short answer that I give, again, when I think about how we are as a species, the answer is because being involved in work gives you status. And we are the most status-hungry things on the planet. We're the most social species. Every other social mammal has an intense status hierarchy. So do social birds. This is where the idea of a pecking order comes from. Great, we have one too. Ours are more subtle, they're more elaborate. They're not just based on whether I beat you up or you beat me up physically. They're very, very elaborate, but they're real. And if you let people loose, they're guaranteed to do is invent all of these status games and all these status ladders that they can then try to climb. And they will do it even if it drives down the share price of the company, because we are not wired by evolution to care about the share price of a company.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I was trying to think back to, interviews I'd done. And there was a clip I wanted to bring back based on the fact that you wrote so much about status from a conversation I had with Mitch Prinstein. Take a listen.
We really focus on status and we think of that as the only kind of popularity that matters. But exactly like you say, the research suggests that those people that peak in high school, they tend to get so positively rewarded at a time when the brain really makes us crave those rewards that they very often live the rest of their lives still working from the same playbook. And usually after you graduate high school, that doesn't work. That's why they peaked when they were in high school.
You know, the reason I brought back that clip is because when you think about geeks, right? These are the people who don't peak in high school per se,
yeah,
right?
Personally, often, I find that super gratifying and I agree wholeheartedly with that quote, right? That's, yeah, right on.
Yeah, you thanks, and I man. Both, right? It's just like, oh, wow. So this is what happened to the high school quarterback. Like, you know, but that, I think that, you know, that struck me, you know, in particular, because you're right. Like, I think that at our core, like, even when we think about, like, I see this often with people who try to select podcast guests. Like, I've seen it in, you know, people like, oh, and I realize that it often, like, when we judge people entirely based on their perceived status, we miss out on really invaluable opportunities. Like, I had a mentor who literally came up with the name Unmistakable Creative, without a question, the most influential person in terms of where I've ended up and what I've done. And I remember when I met him, he had 150 followers on Twitter. He was six weeks into a project. Nobody knew who the hell he was. And I was like, there's something interesting about this guy. And he ended up becoming like invaluable. And so when you think about status, like, what is the role of status as it relates to this geek norm of ownership?
One thing to keep in mind is that, as I said, we humans play incredibly rich status games. They seem to be much richer than any other species because of our big brains and big social groups. So we have status based on dominance, and that really is chimpanzee status. That's, can I beat the snot out of you? And we're still attuned to that. I tell the story about being at a conference and my brain saying, oh, watch out, man. And I'm like, I'm at some kind of tech conference. What are you talking about? And I looked over and there's the boxer Mike Tyson, who is the most physically formidable person I have ever seen in my life. And I want to be super clear. Tyson was not being threatening, right? He wasn't coming at me. He was like reading the program and holding a cup of coffee. But that dude is engineered to inflict damage on other people. And my brain saw that out of the corner of my eye. I was like, you better watch it. There's a very high status person nearby. I contrast that with Yo-Yo Ma, who I also know a little bit. The other kind of human status, which is not nearly as widely shared elsewhere in the animal kingdom, is based on prestige, is based on being very, very good at something. And both those kinds of status work for us in an evolutionary sense. So the story you told about your mentor, he sounds to me like a high prestige person, very good at what he did, might not be universally known, might not be on top of any org chart, but you respected him. He, in some social group, he had status. And that's a very, very good evolutionary strategy for people.
Yeah. Well, I think that the other thing that struck me here was that you said to ensure that autonomous teams remain aligned with the company's overall goals, geek companies rely on a bureaucracy that's powerful but tight constrained. Its job is to oversee the work of translating the company's high-level vision and strategies into team-level goals and associated with the objectives and key results we saw in the previous chapter. So talk to me about how you balance this autonomy with like tightly constrained bureaucracy, because like I think that people think, wait, how the hell can autonomy and bureaucracy coexist?
And they can't to a large extent, which is why some of the geek companies that I think have gone farthest with this norm of ownership, and I'm thinking of Amazon, for example. I talk a fair about it in the book, how hard they worked to decouple small teams from each other, both technologically and organizationally, so that they really did have autonomy. They really did have authority and responsibility and ownership. But they realized that if you do that and you don't, those teams aren't aligned, they're not all pulling in the same direction, you've just generated chaos, right? You just generated a swarm of teams doing whatever they want. So the geeks are obsessed with one kind of bureaucracy, which is the bureaucracy that makes sure that the work of the team is aligned with the overall goals of the organization, and then sets up the monitoring of that group's performance. How are we going to see if the alignment remains over time? We have to increase observability. We have to decrease plausible deniability. And part of the genius of modularity is you can't say, oh, that other group held me up and stopped me from making progress. No, man, you're not dependent on any other group. Your progress is your responsibility. So it accomplishes both of these goals of high observability and low plausible deniability. And it gives people what they want, which is autonomy, which is, you know, a sense of agency in the world while keeping the groups aligned with the overall goals of the organization. Bezos and his colleagues at Amazon worked crazy hard on that. Benioff at Salesforce, when he started Salesforce, realized how important that could be. They spun up a process they call V2MOM. That's their alignment process. And Benioff credits it with a big part of Salesforce's success. A lot of my California friends have worked at Salesforce at one time or another. And they're like, yeah, you would go look up somebody's V2MOM on the internet before you'd meet with them. It suffused the organization. It was pervasive. And John Doerr wrote books about Measure What Matters and the OKR process. They're all saying the same thing. If give people autonomy, that's awesome. But you have to increase observability and decrease plausible deniability. And you have to make sure that what they're doing up front is aligned with what you're trying to achieve as an organization. It's an easy playbook to state. It's hard to do in practice, but conceptually, it's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's making me think of two people I hired. One, literally, I remember bringing her on. I was like, this is what I need you to do. I don't have any clue how to do it. I need you to figure it all out. And I literally never had to talk. Like, I'd meet with her once a week, and the meetings were basically, this is what I've done. This is what I'm doing. I'll get back to you next. That was it. I was like, this is amazing. Like, I she set the gold standard for what I look for. And I realized now finding that another person was incredibly difficult, almost impossible. But that takes us to the next, you know, natural evolution of this, which is this geek norm of speed. And I think that, you know, it's funny because I remember Ben Flyberg. I don't remember exactly how to pronounce his name. He wrote the book, How Big Things Happen, right? And he talked about this as well, like how we tend to, you know, overestimate how quickly we can get something done. And even Cal Newport, in his most recent book, Slow Productivity, he actually gave a suggestion, which was to double the time estimate on every project in order to work at a more natural pace. But I think the thing that stood out to me here when you talked about speed was that you said speed here doesn't mean velocity. It's not how fast people and projects are moving toward the finish line. Rather, it's speed of iteration, how quickly a team can create something that works in meaningful and measurable sense, present it to a customer and get feedback on it. And it got me thinking. I was like, okay, so what does this look like in my writing process? Mm. You know, like as a creator, like what does this look like on the company level? Then, you know, let's kind of boil it down to the example of like an individual working on a creative endeavor.
And here's, I think, the fundamental insight that I had when I was writing that chapter is that in any big effort, long effort, complicated, interdependent, define big however you want. In any big effort, there are lots of places to hide. There are lots of places to hide the fact that you're falling behind or the fact that things might not be going well. And the bigger the effort, the longer, the more interdependent it is, the more places there are to hide. And I want to be super clear about this. I think the person that we hide most from is ourselves. You know, Srini, I wrote a book where I talk a lot about our human biases and overconfidence and how things are late. Did I deliver this manuscript on time? Did I hit my... you can feel the lead up. The answer is no, I did not. We hide from ourselves. And that means, because we're we're confident, we hide from other people the true state of progress going on. And so I think that's the fundamental phenomenon, is that in big efforts, there are plenty of places to hide, and we very, very smart, strategizing at an unconscious level, ultra social creatures, we take advantage of those places. So to me, my norm of speed is essentially about getting rid of those places to hide. And a great way to do that is to say, okay, your deadline's not 6 months from now. No, your deadline's next week. And you're going to present something to a customer, and they're going to give the group the thumbs up or the thumbs down about whether you're on pace or not. And by doing that, by chunking up a big project and by making people show their work and making somebody give it a thumbs up or thumbs down, again, we're back to our old friends. We have increased observability. We've driven plausible deniability down, and we have shown a flashlight on so many of those places to hide in a big project. And to me, that's the heart of agile development, all these agile methods that we've been talking about in the 21st century. That's the core of their success. It's one of the really important things they do is they just remove the places to hide on big, complicated efforts. And therefore, the research on agile, very, very clear, is that compared to the old-fashioned methods of project management, it ain't even close. Not perfect. Big things are hard to do. But holy cow, does this agile iterative approach work better? Well, and it was wild because I think Brent was writing his book, How Big Things Get Done, at the same time I was writing The Geek Way. I relied on an article he'd written, but not the book. But we were essentially writing each other's books using different examples in somewhat different language.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's making me think I'm working on translating one of our podcast interviews into a film for an AI film festival. And, you know, I've been going through storyboarding, but like one of the very first things I did was generate images, throw them into the generator. And I'm like, let me just see what this looks like, you know, theoretically. And I was trying to do like a Pixar style thing. I was like, there's too much distortion in this. Like literally it was one iteration after another. And then finally, when I settled on a style, the speed at which I was able to go was like exponentially faster. This question struck me. I love this question so much that you post in the book. Why are kindergartners so much better than B-school tycoons in training? And it got me thinking. I remember thinking about this in the context of Congress when we're in the middle of the pandemic and they were trying to figure out whether they're going to do another round of relief. And I was like, a bunch of kindergartners would have come to a decision faster than this. So talk to me about this idea. Like, what happens to adults that they lose this ability to act this way?
I think there are a couple things going on that seem to reliably slow us down as we age. One of them is what we just talked about, which is the quest for status. And when you look at how MBA students start a group project, you see all this status jockeying going on. The other thing is a flavor of overconfidence. We get really fond of our ability to plan things out, to anticipate all the possible contingencies and roadmaps and find ways around them. We love planning. Danny Kahneman says it's so deeply ingrained that it deserves its own label. He calls it the planning fallacy. Okay, great. Both of those things get in our way of being able to start work and start iterating quickly on a project. Kindergartners don't have as much of that. And when you give them a challenge like, hey, build the tallest tower you can out of this spaghetti uncooked and tape and the marshmallow has to go on top, they're like, sweet. And they just start building weird looking things that actually work pretty well. The first ones don't work well, but then the kindergarten's like, oh, okay, I'll try something else. And apparently, I haven't verified this myself, apparently a room full of kindergartners will do better than a room full of MBAs on average at building tall towers of uncooked spaghetti where the marshmallow has to be on top. It's called the marshmallow challenge. And having done it with a few different MBA audiences, I can attest the average performance is really not very good. That's true. I thought again it was an exaggeration or an urban myth. No, I've done it a couple of times. They do not cover themselves in glory.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think about, you know, a conversation that I had. There was an aspiring podcaster. I met her at some mixer and she must have asked me like 100 questions. And I realized it led to sort of this basis for a blog post I'm writing titled "There's No Substitute for Knowledge Gained Through Experience." Like literally, she would. I finally told her, I was like, let me just tell you right now, I don't know the answer to any of these questions. And she's probably thinking, what an asshole. Like, you're supposed to help me. You're the guy who's done a podcast for 10 years. And I was like, you're asking questions that you can only find out the answers to by going and doing something.
It gets to another one of the benefits of speed that I didn't understand at all when I started writing the book. And shame on me. In addition to the cultural, the species superpower of cultural evolution that we talked about earlier, our other superpower is that we learn better and faster than any other living thing on the planet. And the heart of our learning, especially before we had universities and the scientific method and stuff like that, the heart of our learning is watching other people. We're really good at it. And in particular, we can observe who's good at the task. It really doesn't matter what the task is. Who's good at it? Who are the people who are good at it? And then our brains create kind of a weighted average model of all the good stuff that we saw. And then we apply that model when it's our turn to do something. It's an absolute human superpower. The research is crazy on this. And so what you are experiencing is that every one of your podcasts is what a social scientist would call a generation, another opportunity to learn. And you've listened to other podcasts, and whether or not you're doing it consciously, you're observing and absorbing what worked and what didn't. So you've got a lot of models to choose from. So the reason you become a very good podcaster is that you have tons of generations, and each one of those generations has several models that you can follow in it. That's how you get better over time. And I think that's partly why you didn't feel like you could offer that person any real help, because that knowledge is kind of hard for you to get out there and make explicit out there in the world. So yeah. This agile approach, iterate, do it in public, man, all that's doing is giving you lots of generations and lots of models. You're turbocharging the learning.
Well, it's funny. It makes me think of a ridiculous kind of relatable story to this. So like, you know, my nephew is picking up new words like at an astronomical rate. And you know, so we taught him to say cool dude. And he thinks I'm a cool dude. And it's really funny because he woke up in the morning and he was like, he says that he's a cool dude, that I'm a cool dude. My mom, who is kind of the authoritarian, and he knows she's like, is Amama a cool dude? And she literally won't say it. Like, she cannot get him to say it. And I'm like, whoa, okay. He doesn't think you're a cool dude. And I'm like laughing because I'm like, mom, you're not a cool dude. You're far from chill. Like, there's nice. No, and he's a 1 year old and he knows that.
Out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yeah. Well, let's finish this up by talking about the final piece, which is openness. Like, you know, openness could mean any number of things. And you contrast this with sort of the Model 1 approach, which, you know, you describe in detail, which is, you know, be unilateral in control over things, strive to win and minimize losing, suppress negative feelings. So let me explain these two differences.
Yeah, because openness is kind of it sounds the most loosey-goosey of the concepts, but it might be the most important. Let me try to explain it with two synonyms and an antonym. So the two synonyms, well, number one is psychological safety, which my former Harvard colleague, Amy Edmondson, has been talking about for her whole career, doing such great research on. This feeling like, can I speak truth to power in this environment? Is that okay? So a close synonym for openness, as I'm using it, is psychological safety. Another one is willingness to pivot. Is this not working anymore? Like, do we need to go do something else? And I think pivot has become part of the lexicon of tech for pretty healthy reasons overall. This might not be working. Let's not keep doing it. An antonym for me for openness is defensiveness, because defensiveness is all about digging in your heels and not giving an inch in an argument, not giving up any of the turf that you fought so hard to win, not being willing to accept that you might not be correct in this argument. These are all just aspects of defensiveness. And I think one of the greatest and most underappreciated scholar of organizations was a person who was a very senior professor at Harvard when I was just starting out there, this guy named Chris Argyris, who's kind of a legend, super prestigious in a very small community of organization geeks. And Argyris just said, look, we should expect defensiveness. Of course, people are going to be defensive. They're going to want to hold on to what they have and get more of it. Why should we expect anything else? He didn't use evolutionary terms, but he was speaking my language. And so you've got to fight that very, very deep-rooted tendency, which is hard to do. And the great geek norm of openness is all about fighting those defensive tendencies and making people open, vulnerable, able to pivot, creating environments of psychological safety.
Well, let's finish up with two final things. I think that, you know, people hearing this are probably like, okay, well, this makes sense. And I realize this is going to be a very strange question given how much we've emphasized that we're such a social species, but like, how do people apply this on a day-to-day level, you know, in their individual lives? Like, where do you see this playing out? You know, we go back to the example. For example, we're talking about speed and openness. Openness, I get, like, I should be asking probably friends for feedback on my articles.
And doing it quicker. Earlier in the process.
Exactly. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So talk to me, like, I mean, let's just use writing as an example of how we might apply these on a day-to-day basis, because you and I are both writers. Maybe that's one where we could think about it.
Yeah. And I don't do a great job, but to follow my advice on writing, I'm defensive about it. I'll admit that I need to get better at it. Iterate. I have started doing what you probably know, have heard of as the vomit draft. Just barf it out for the first draft. Get something on the page, because then you can iterate from it. And that means your friends can help you. Other eyeballs can help you. I find that if I go back and look at something I wrote 2 weeks earlier, it's like somebody else wrote it, which means that I'm a better evaluator of it. So you can always start doing that. You cannot succumb to the planning fallacy. You can just start doing instead of planning over time. But more broadly, if you do want to do self-help, you can walk around thinking of yourself as a chronically overconfident person who is defensive, who doesn't want to give up what they've fought so hard to achieve. And you can say, okay, do I want to be better than that? And you can start to say things like to other people, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that. If you're trying to referee a decision, you can say, what evidence led you to make that decision? All right, you know, Srini, what evidence led you to make that decision? You can try to have a debate that's focused more on the ground rules of science. So we can all get a little bit geekier in the ways that I talk about in the book. I think we can do that in our personal lives. And I think we can do that, obviously, in our business lives for whatever sphere of influence we have. But honestly, I think when I started to think of myself not as this wise, rational, smart individual, but as this super messed up member of a very unique, super weird species on the planet, the most ultra social species, with the attendant mental baggage that comes along with that. Oh, that's insight. I might be able to work with that in my daily life.
Wow. Well, I have one final question for you, which is how we finish our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I mean, for me, it's, are they laying stuff on me that I haven't heard before? Are they showing me something new? I guess I'm a novelty junkie. I just like being
you and me both.
I just like being exposed to something new. You know, I love excellence, right? But I'd probably rather watch Roger Federer play tennis because he's like, I never thought of that shot before. Where did that come from? Nadal was an amazing, amazing tennis player, but he just kind of played tennis better and harder with more willpower than anybody else. I have crazy respect for that, but I preferred watching Federer.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with listeners. Like I said, to me, I think this was a social science book disguised as a business book, which is why I loved it so much. Because on the surface, you might think, oh, just another business book about tech and Silicon Valley, and it's so not. This is something I think that is really relatable to anybody. But where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else you're up to?
I'm at andrewmcafee.org. I'm A. McAfee on Twitter, AMCAF like Frank, EE. And I'm going to be firing up a Substack soon. And I shoot my mouth off there.
And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys and download your free copy.